Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, another full house at the Lowy Institute. Welcome to the Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the director. Let me acknowledge one of my board members, Stephen Lowy, as well as other distinguished guests, including Richard Maud, Acting Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, a number of consuls, general members of the Institute and others. I'm delighted to welcome you all to today's event with the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Senator Maurice Payne. Ladies and gentlemen, we're entering a difficult period in international relations. Nationalism and protectionism are rising. Faith in democracy is falling. Strong men and authoritarians are up on their hind legs. International norms are being flouted. Assassinations and extrajudicial executions on foreign soil seem to be multiplying. The UK is exiting the European Union, which will weaken both Britain and the West. And the leader of the free world doesn't seem to care much about the free world. So there's a lot happening in the world, and in our region too, the pace of diplomacy is picking up. We recently saw a flurry of announcements, but no joint communique produced at a remarkable APEC summit in Port Moresby. We all look forward to the G20 summit in Buenos Aires this weekend. What could go wrong? So this is a very good time indeed to be hosting the Australian Foreign Minister. Ladies and gentlemen, Maurice Payne entered Parliament in 1997 as a Senator for New South Wales, and during her parliamentary career she served as a Shadow Minister and Minister in a number of demanding portfolios. As Defence Minister, Senator Payne oversaw the delivery of the 2016 Defence White Paper, in which the Turnbull Government committed that by 2020-2021, Australia would spend 2% of its GDP on defence. The government deserves credit for its actions in restoring Australia's defence budget. For Australia, the era of cheap security is over. 3 months ago, Maurice Payne was appointed Foreign Minister. On a personal note, I've known Maurice for over 25 years. I first met her when I was a uni student and a member of the National Committee of the Australian Republican Movement. We were dedicated to the controversial proposition that Australia's head of state should be an Australian. And in 1994, Maurice joined the National Committee as Malcolm Turnbull's vice chair of the Republican Movement. And at the time, that was quite a controversial thing for an ambitious young Liberal to do, and I admired her for doing so. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the lectern the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Senator Payne.
Thank you very much, Michael, for your warm introduction. And once he starts saying the dates, I've got no secrets left, really, which is a little, frustrating. In fact, after a sitting week, I look 10 years older than I actually am anyhow. So, well, that's my excuse. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you so much, as I said, Michael, for your very warm words. Can I start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet here in the centre of Sydney's CBD today and pay my respects to elders past and present. I want to acknowledge Michael, the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute, who, of course, needs no introduction himself. The work he has done here at Lowy is most impressive and well-renowned, and it's a great pleasure to be working with you in the roles I've held in the last few years. He's right about the Australian Republican Movement. I think you used the word courageous, some might have said foolhardy, and it may explain my extremely well-developed professional career as a backbencher in the Howard government for a long period of time. To Steve Lowy, thank you so much, Steve, for being here today. I very much appreciate it. Deputy Secretary, Acting Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Richard Maud, Your Excellencies, members of the Consular Corps, and the very many distinguished guests and quite a few familiar faces in the room. Thank you for being here this afternoon. And it is a pleasure to be here in my first address to the Lowy Institute as Foreign Minister. It was fabulous to work with Lowy on your Pacific Forum in Canberra not so long ago, which was also a great opportunity to talk about some of the security-related work of the government in that capacity, though, as Defence Minister. It's fair to say that this address has been a long time coming and that Michael and his team have been very patient. As we've juggled dates around my parliamentary commitments and travel, and occasionally Michael's travel as well. But we are here now, and that is a very good thing. Ladies and gentlemen, I was unable to attend the Lowy Institute annual dinner this year when Sir Frank Lowy spoke on that occasion. But I did write to Sir Frank in advance of that evening and noted the significant contribution that the Institute has made to our regional and global global affairs policy debate in Australia. It doesn't matter whether it's here or at events like the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. I'm always certain that Michael and his team and members of his team will be there on the ground listening and asking the tough questions, it's fair to say. The fine reputation of the Lowy Institute precedes them, so they are always welcome, and it's a great pleasure to be here today. I wanted to start by making some observations about the duty of a government, because the first duty of any government in Australia is to keep our nation and the Australian people safe. But in 2018, that task is becoming increasingly complex. There are more dimensions to security than ever before in a period of increasing strategic uncertainty and very rapid technological change. There's no doubting the fact that we also live in complex times. Many factors contribute to that complexity, not least amongst them a rising, more assertive China, a United States which is asking its allies and partners to contribute more to global security and chafing at what it believes are failings, for example, in the global trading system. The 2017 White Paper charted the key trends: rising nationalism and geopolitical competition, anti-globalisation and trade protectionism, rapid technological change, and the shift in power to the Indo-Pacific. Not only were those assessments accurate at the time, in the years since, the trends have become sharper and change has in fact accelerated. Advances in technology show no sign of slowing, with robotics, artificial intelligence, and machine learning set to continue to reshape our day-to-day lives every day in the years ahead. This technological revolution, and it has been and still is a revolution, is having far-reaching impacts on national, regional, and global security. The continuation of this period of prosperity and stability in the decades ahead will require the impacts of these new technologies to be addressed and for the international community to set global norms for their use. Our government is committed to supporting the rules and the norms that have been so important for our security and prosperity. But the world is not standing still, and we have to ensure that the international system is fit for purpose and able to address 21st century challenges. Today, when we think about global security, we think about it in very broad terms. Where's the battlefield today? Where are the battle lines drawn? Are they lines on a map? Are they coordinates on a disputed seabed? Are they claimed jurisdiction over shipping lanes? Or are they actually invisible? Are they the gaps between computers in cyberspace, or covert control exercised over the cloud? Are they in space? Or are they actually in the contest of ideas, in radicalisation, in militant ideology? Is it the millions of refugees fleeing a crisis, crossing borders on land and at sea? Is it a terrorist training camp somewhere, far from crowded city streets, in a remote and poorly governed country? Or is it a terrorist lone actor, radicalised somewhere on those crowded streets, in a densely populated, well-governed part of the world? The answer to those multiple questions, obviously, but sadly, is that in 2018, all of those places are the battle lines. Broader aspects of security: health security, irregular mass people movements, counter-terrorism, space, cyber, impacts of climate, efforts to fight the spread of nuclear and chemical weapons are now also a core part of national and international work. And some of these are relatively new as security concepts, but they're now central to our thinking and our efforts. So this government, for example, has an ambassador for counter-terrorism, an ambassador for cyber affairs, an ambassador for people smuggling and human trafficking, and a number of others who represent us in the key security fora covering those issues. And security today also is not just an issue for state actors. So technological change, economies of scale, globalisation have been so profound and continue to occur with such speed that global security is now also dependent on and vulnerable to the actions of non-state and corporate actors. Let me put the proposition that perhaps the most obvious place in which that is true is in the cyber domain. Every aspect of our global society now is touched by technology, much of it developed not by governments or state enterprises, but by the private sector. That fact creates immense opportunities for innovation, for efficiencies, for change and for growth, but it also opens every aspect of what we do to new vulnerabilities. For example, low-cost internet-connected devices, the Internet of Things, are increasingly being targeted by cyber criminals with malware that is increasingly targeting devices with greater capability, like home routers. We're relatively good, give or take, at securing our own computers, our iPads, our phones from those vulnerabilities, but much less so at securing our fridges, our smart lights, or even CCTV cameras. Along with government, industry is now a target for cyber penetration as rival companies, state and non-state actors seek political, military, commercial, and technological advantages. Last month, Australia joined other nations in condemning the Russian government's military cyber operations against the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons and various Malaysian locations conducting the MH17 investigations. It should go without saying, using cyber tools to interfere with the global organisation dedicated to verification and compliance of our agreed chemical weapons prohibition must be condemned in the strongest terms because it is a fundamental attack on the integrity of the arms control and disarmament framework we rely on for collective security. Likewise, it should go without saying, but I will say it, that interfering with the investigation into the shooting down of MH17 in the Ukraine is unacceptable, particularly given the Russian involvement in the disaster itself. Australia supports a free, secure, and open internet that drives economic growth, protects national security, and promotes international stability. The government, through my agency, DFAT, and others, is actively engaged in protecting Australia's interests online and offline. First, we are working hard to build international consensus around prohibited activity in cyberspace. Major nations, including the United States, Russia, China, and others, have agreed that existing international law applies in cyberspace. They have also agreed a number of norms of acceptable behaviour, for instance, that nations should not use cyber tools to damage critical infrastructure during peacetime, as a complement to the existing prohibition on indiscriminate attacks against non-combatants and civilian populations during armed conflict. Having agreed the rules of the road, we have to ensure that countries act in accordance with them. Secondly, we're always working to deter and respond to cyber incidents. We have a range of economic, legal, political, diplomatic tools that we're prepared to use and have used to hold accountable states and corporations found to have initiated or participated in cyber incidents. Australia's defensive and offensive cyber capabilities also enable us to deter and respond to the threat of malicious cyber actors. Thirdly, we're working with industry and commerce through the Australian Signals Directorate and the Australian Cybersecurity Centre to build up resilience, rapid response, the hardening of our systems and networks exposed to cyber incidents. This is about building a natural inclination towards cooperation, which builds trust and confidence in what are very cyber-dependent contemporary lifestyles. And finally, we also invest in building regional capacity with our neighbours to improve cyber resilience. And we have done that through an almost $40 million program in the Indo-Pacific. In fact, just preceding APEC in Papua New Guinea, with their Minister for Communications, Information Technology and Energy, Sam Basil, in APEC week, I opened Papua New Guinea's new National Cybersecurity Centre, which we helped to establish. Not only did it play a real and genuine role in protecting APEC, it also helps to build PNG's long-term cyber resilience, to harness the opportunities and to mitigate the risks of increased connectivity, which will be delivered throughout the Coral Sea Cable Project. And it helps to build the trust in our relationship as well. After the cyber domain, I want to turn to space. Because rapid technological advancement is also bringing access to space into the reach of more nations and more businesses. Much of our everyday infrastructure absolutely relies on satellites in space for services. The banking system depends on the atomic clocks embedded in global navigation satellite systems for timestamping innumerable transactions from simple emails to complex deals on the stock exchange. Electricity grids depend on the satellites for synchronising increasingly complex systems of energy supply and demand, as do other vital services such as air and sea navigation, emergency services, and, of course, military operations. It's not surprising, then, that the United Kingdom government designated space as critical national infrastructure in 2015. And in fact, the United States and the United Kingdom have both recently declared space as the fifth warfighting domain alongside the ground, sea, air, and cyber domains of conflict. And in the United States, the President has commissioned the establishment of a space force as the sixth branch of the armed forces, alongside the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, and the Coast Guard. In the past year, the question of weaponising space has become a major strategic issue. In the United Nations, Russia and China proposed the No First Placement of Weapons in Outer Space resolution. And last month, Australia, with a number of other partners, voted against that resolution. And the key issue for Australia and for the US was uncertainty about identifying the genuine purpose of any particular space-based asset. While its declared or public purpose might be identified as civilian in nature, there is a growing risk associated with so-called dual-use technologies, where a satellite might also be used as a weapon. For example, to deliberately collide with a peaceful use satellite. The international regulatory regime relating to space is an area of rapid and difficult change. Our international framework for outer space is not so new. It was essentially put in place by the 1980s. But to return to whether systems and structures are fit for purpose in the 21st century, there are increasing questions about that given new and emerging technologies. And while Australia and many of our allies are open to new legally binding treaties, we're also working hard on processes that can deliver better trust and transparency faster than the complex treaty processes usually allow. Through the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Australia supports transparency and confidence and building measures based on those two factors as a means of rapidly improving space security. By getting better at sharing information, at building mutual understanding and reducing tensions in this fairly new area of engagement, we believe championing and in certain cases mandating these transparency and confidence building measures are a useful way of shaping long-term state behaviour. Thirdly, Likewise, whether on space or on Earth, Australia works hard to counter the spread of weapons of mass destruction. If you wanted to list the big security issues that have troubled the global community this year, certainly concerns about the nuclear aspirations of North Korea, of Iran, must come at or near the top. I certainly spent a significant proportion of last year and the beginning of this year as Australia's Minister for Defence, very focused on the DPRK. But the reprehensible re-emergence of the use of chemical weapons, used in violation of international prohibitions in Syria and in Iraq, the use of chemicals for assassinations and attempted assassinations in Malaysia, in the United Kingdom, have been a stark reminder that this debate is not only about the nuclear threat. Australia is active in our support for the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, for the Chemical and Biological Weapons Conventions, the Proliferation Security Initiative, and major strategic export control regimes like the Australia Group. And much of that work, of course, happens outside the public eye, and it relies on cooperative international effort. But we do have significant and important wins, and I think it is important to mark those. Meeting at The Hague in June of this year, Australia and other like-minded partners were successful in our global lobbying efforts to have the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons take on a mandate to be able to attribute responsibility for the use of chemical weapons in ways that no country can veto. It was an important outcome, potentially transformative as a deterrent for future potential perpetrators, and a demonstration that the rules-based system that we fight hard for can adapt to modern challenges. While space, cyber, weapons of mass destruction all require the use of increasingly sophisticated technology, unfortunately and too regularly, there are urban and semi-urban attacks across the world, most recently in Bourke Street in Melbourne, which are tragic reminders of the threat of low or no technology attacks. Terrorist groups have proven to be agile and innovative. And a significant part of the work of my portfolio in this area is promoting strong regional and international counter-terrorism frameworks to ensure that would-be terrorists can't plan, communicate, or operate with impunity. We've made significant gains in recent years to counter Daesh, to counter Daesh-affiliated groups. It is a fact that Daesh has lost 98% of the territory it once held in Syria and Iraq on the ground. But their activities online and elsewhere continue. So they continue to spread their toxic ideology, and the risk of battle-hardened fighters returning to this region remains real. We have seen that again too recently, as you would be aware, with the AFP and ASIO believing that the attacker in Bourke Street was inspired, a perverse use of the word inspired in my view, by this extremist group. In our region, in the southern Philippines, a significant effort by the armed forces of the Philippines liberated the city of Marawi after it was captured by militant extremist Islamic fighters. It was an important victory which came at a great cost. The ADF has assisted at the time with air surveillance assets during the conflict, and since then, with our regional partner in the Philippines, we've conducted exchanges of information and tactics with more than 6,000 Philippines troops to better prepare partners in the region to deter and respond to future attacks. A number of the terrorist groups in the Philippines have pledged explicit allegiance to Daesh. That is a matter of deep concern to Australia. And of course, military forces can't on their own defeat terrorists or terrorism. This is one area where fundamentally we need a multi-partner approach, and our alliance with the US and other regional partners and friends is critical. In March, Australia signed an MOU on countering terrorism with the nations of ASEAN at the Australia-ASEAN Special Summit, a document underpinned and supported by a range of programs, including technical assistance on developing anti-terror legislation. Those frameworks are important for accountability, for responsibility, and for enforcement. We're working closely with partners in Southeast Asia, and particularly with Indonesia, a vital partner for us in countering evolving threats. And we continue to work with partner countries on the difficult issue of returning foreign terrorist fighters, a security risk, as I said, faced by many in our region. Across all security domains, we have a particular and clear focus on our immediate region. As Defence Minister, I spent a lot of time in the Pacific, and I've continued that focus on Foreign Minister. And I briefly added that up. In the last 12 months, as either Defence or Foreign Minister, I have been engaged with my counterparts and visited Fiji, Tonga, Solomon Islands, New Caledonia, and of course Nauru, most recently for the Pacific Island Forum. The security of the Pacific is one of our highest foreign policy priorities. I don't need to remind you that it's where we live, and it's in our national interest to keep the region stable and secure. We work closely with Pacific Island countries on a broad range of regional challenges, including climate change, maritime and border security, transnational crime, illegal fishing, migration, drugs, and a whole range of things. And our support is executed in close partnership with our Pacific neighbours in support of their priorities. And in September, we signed with those partners the Boy Declaration at the Pacific Island Forum in Nauru as a foundation for future regional responses on those security challenges. And we're backing up those words with action. Since I took on this role, we've announced the establishment of a Pacific Fusion Centre in response to calls from Pacific leaders for greater information sharing in the region. The need for awareness and information is very, very prevalent, very, very front of mind for them. Based in the Pacific, it will bring together information sources and officials from across the region to analyse and respond to security threats, including some of those I've identified. We're working in partnership with Vanuatu to build their security capability, including infrastructure upgrades and enhanced training and leadership opportunities for the Vanuatu Police Force. In Fiji, we've agreed to support the redevelopment of the Black Rock Camp into a regional hub for police and peacekeeping training and pre-deployment preparation. And we're partnering with Papua New Guinea on a major joint initiative to develop the Lombram Naval Base in Manus Province. Papua New Guinea has also invited the United States to be part of the redevelopment. Our government has continued to deliver the step up of our efforts in the region across the full breadth of our engagement. And I'd like to give you a comprehensive list of all of our recent initiatives, but we'd be here for quite some time, so let me do that in brief. We are providing strong economic opportunities through the expanded Pacific Labour Scheme and the existing seasonal worker program. We're stepping up our support for regional infrastructure development with the establishment of an Australian Infrastructure Financing Facility for the Pacific to help address major infrastructure financing gaps facing our regional partners. We're expanding our diplomatic presence to every Pacific Island Forum country, and we will be the only country with a presence in every Pacific Island Forum country. New posts in the Cook Islands, Niue, French Polynesia, Palau, and the Marshall Islands. And we are strengthening our long-standing people-to-people links, which are so powerful between Australia and the Pacific, across a range of activities. For example, in sports, rugby league, rugby union, netball, football, basketball, and at a community level, working to build much stronger church partnerships. It is all part of the effort to ensure that we live in a region that is secure strategically, stable economically, and sovereign politically. The Asian Development Bank estimates that the Pacific needs more than $3.1 billion US in infrastructure investment each year to 2030. It's a significant challenge, and it's not one that can be met by any one country. As we have consistently said, Australia welcomes all investment that is transparent, that upholds robust standards, that meets genuine needs, and avoids unsustainable debt burdens. Reinforcing that, Australia has signed a trilateral MOU with the US and Japan to mobilise private capital to help address the region's significant infrastructure needs. And there is, of course, a range of other issues affecting the stability of the Indo-Pacific region. I would cite one in particular, very close to us, in a member of ASEAN, in terms of Myanmar. The crisis in Myanmar is a significant and very, very complex challenge. It has the potential to continue to deteriorate, and it has the potential to open the door to the radicalisation of disaffected individuals and groups. Australia is committed to working with Myanmar and with our regional partners, and it's a matter on which I have spent a great deal of time with interlocutors from this region and further afield to find a long-term solution. I intend to travel to Myanmar as soon as I can to engage there, to further my conversations with colleagues in Bangladesh and to work closely with colleagues in trying to identify steps towards a solution, which I believe is still some time away, but an absolute imperative. Ladies and gentlemen, any country's ability to do the sorts of things that I've been talking about in security depends on a strong economy. And a strong economy is what enables us to provide additional capital to EFIC, our export financing agency, to support investments in the region, to fund an activity like our Pacific Maritime Security Program. And a strong economy adds weight to our diplomatic efforts. That's why we also place great importance on our economic diplomacy that continues to promote Australia as an attractive place to visit, to study and to invest. This week, the government launched our new economic and commercial diplomacy agenda, designed to prioritise ongoing effective engagement with Australian business at the forefront of our international engagement. Using our full suite of diplomatic resources, we will continue to advocate for an open global economy to support Australian businesses seeking commercial opportunities in major emerging markets and to strengthen our international competitiveness. We are an active member of APEC, of the G20, of the WTO, and we will continue in that role to be a strong advocate for global economic growth and cooperation. We have commissioned and released the India Economic Strategy, executed by Peter Varghese, well known to many of you in this room. It sets out a roadmap for the Australia-India economic relationship to 2035. We've endorsed that strategy, its 10 short-term and 10 long-term priority recommendations, and we've agreed to an initial implementation plan across government. And I look forward to building on that momentum, which I felt physically, literally, in the presence of the President of India last week when he was here in Sydney and Melbourne. Not to a cricket result he was after, I might say, but nevertheless, I look forward to building on that momentum when I visit India early in the new year to participate in the Raisina Dialogue. It's going to be a very busy 2019 as the government works to ensure the continued long-term security and stability of our region. But the foundations that I've spoken to you about today, the foundations that underpin that work, will give us the platform on which to move into 2019. Thank you again very much for having me here at Lowy today. The duty of government in keeping Australia and Australians safe in 2018 is truly a multidimensional task that requires multidimensional responses. But I can assure you it has the absolute focus of your government. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister, for doing us the compliment of giving us such an interesting and substantive speech. We have about 20 minutes for Q&A, and the Minister's agreed to take our questions. I'm going to ask the first question, so it gives you a little bit of time to think what you'd like to ask. When you have a question, please raise your hand, get my attention, and wait for a microphone. Senator, I'm going to ask you about the Pacific, if I may. You ran through the government's impressive series of announcements that comprise the Pacific Step Up, from the new posts, which we at the Institute welcome, the naval base in Manus and all the other things you enumerated. How much is the Australian step up a reaction to China's step up in the region? And how concerned are you by China's increased interest in our near neighbourhood?
I think what I have seen since Prime Minister Turnbull then announced the step up at a Pacific Island Forum meeting a couple of years ago now, what I have seen is a broadening and a deepening of Australia's engagement across the region because it's our region. That is the first and foremost reason that we do what we do. whether it is identify changes, if you like, in our approach over decades. And I think I think scholarships are a really good example of this. Without confessing my age too publicly, when I was at high school, would be so for many in this room, it was not unusual to see scholarship students from around the Pacific in our high schools, particularly in Queensland and parts of New South Wales, depending on where their families were often. But that gradually trailed away. And we think that that is a very important foundational activity for building people-to-people links. So we are going to reintroduce that. That's not a response to anybody else in the region. That's an important thing to do for the Australia-Pacific relationship. And so it is the case on so many security questions as well. As I have moved around the Pacific in the last year, and it's fair to say that in my previous ministerial role, which was as the Minister for Human Services, it was not an area in which I was exposed to this. But as I moved around the Pacific in the last year or so in my previous role, the expanding nature of the security challenge that the Pacific nations are dealing with became absolutely apparent to me. So in casual conversations with leaders from Samoa, from Tonga, their observations about what they were trying to deal with in terms of the movement of narcotics and people, weapons, and so on. Very, very different from 20 or even 10 years ago. So Australia is in a position, and in a position in the region, to address, to help, and to engage. In terms of the involvement of others in the region, and you've specifically mentioned China, we have consistently said, and I have consistently said, that we welcome the engagement of the international community in this region. I set out, in dollar terms, the size of the infrastructure challenge, so more than $3 billion US per year until 2030. No one country can do that, certainly not Australia. So the important foundation, though, that has to underpin that involvement is an approach that is respectful of Pacific countries' priorities, that is done in partnership, that does not add to the insecurity or instability of the region, and we encourage all those who work in the region to adopt that approach an encouraging way.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to start on that side of the room with Elaine.
Thanks, Foreign Minister. I'm Elaine Pearson from Human Rights Watch. You mentioned Myanmar in your remarks, and I guess I had a follow-up question. In response to the UN fact-finding mission's report on Myanmar, you talked about the need for justice and accountability. And one of the specific recommendations from that report was for the UN Security Council to refer Myanmar to the International Criminal Court. Is that something that the Australian government would publicly support, referral of Myanmar to the International Criminal Court, as Canada, Sweden and the Netherlands have already done?
Thanks very much, Elaine. I sat down with Chris Sidoti, who again would be known to many people in this room, but was an Australian member of the UN fact-finding mission on Myanmar. I sat down with him in this building, at the completion of the and release of the full report, and spent quite some time with him discussing their report and their recommendations. We've said in relation to that recommendation that we would be prepared to consider that. In terms of the makeup of the Security Council, it's not clear whether it would be adopted, but it is certainly something we are prepared to consider, yes.
My name's Jemima Garrett. I work in the Pacific now, and I have done in media for 30 years. And it's very welcome to see the government expanding the number of missions in the Pacific Islands. And also you mentioned the contest of ideas. In the Pacific, there are now 10 Pacific Island Forum nations that have no radio service from the Pacific. And in terms of current affairs and debate, that's still where it's at technologically. Mm. And I'm just wondering if you would consider, as part of initiatives that might come out of the soft power review, for instance, expanding that fairly cost-effective area of Australia's involvement in the region.
Thank you. I think the the decisions that have been taken in recent years about broadcasting in the Pacific, radio, and also what level of Australian content as well is available in the Pacific, ones which have been of interest to us in our work that we've been doing on the step up. It is something at which we are still considering, and of course, as you say, DFAT does have its soft power review underway, and you should collar Deputy Secretary Maud here before he leaves, and make sure he hears that message loud and clear. But I think he's got perfect hearing, and I'm sure he's picked it up. But yes, it is a very important matter, and something which we're looking at.
Brian Everingham, Institute of International Affairs. While appreciating your recent announcements and your repetition of those here regarding the Pacific today, it's also quite obvious that there have been several clumsy remarks by ministers in the last few years that have caused damage and embarrassment within the Pacific. And remembering that the World Conservation Union's conference here had those Pacific leaders talking about the existential threat of climate change, where in the heaven's name will this government be going in that regard, noting that this is their big issue?
Well, Brian, very happy to answer that question. Of course, we were, with all the members of the Pacific Island Forum, signatories to the Boy Declaration on Regional Security, which was adopted at the Pacific Island Forum meeting in Nauru, and the first affirmation in that declaration is, we reaffirm that climate change remains the single greatest threat to the livelihoods, security and well-being of the peoples of the Pacific, and our commitment to progress the implementation of the Paris Agreement. And so a great deal of the work that we do in the region, and in fact embedded in our development assistance approach, is a focus on the challenges that are being caused by climate, including a focus on adaptation and on resilience, and on working very closely with our partners on the things that are important to them in that regard. The Prime Minister has met recently in Papua New Guinea at the end of the APEC meeting with all of the Pacific leaders who were able to attend, and you can be absolutely confident that they reinforced that message to him there.
Alex Oliver from the Institute.
Thank you very much, Minister, for that
An
speech.
An in-house question.
They're allowed.
Allow us. We've been doing a lot of work since 2009, Minister, which I know you're aware of, about Australia's diplomatic network and its representation around the world. And we welcome the announcement of the 5 new posts in the Pacific. And I note that the Labor Party has also promised a number of new posts in the Pacific. What we've been concerned about is the level of funding to Australia's diplomatic network and to the Department of Foreign Affairs, which has remained essentially static in the last 30 years. And in fact, we have around 30% fewer diplomats now than we did 30 years ago posted abroad. So while there's a bigger diplomatic network, and we've welcomed the posts that this government has opened in the last few years, there's actually a smaller amount of, about the same amount of money and a smaller number of diplomats to service those posts. And I was wondering what you propose to do with the upcoming budget for resourcing of Australia's diplomatic network.
Feel free to break some news today, Maurice.
It would be unusual for a cabinet minister to do that, and courageous, and I don't intend to take either an unusual or a courageous step in that regard. But I note the point that you make. I would have to say, though, the nature of work in any line of work has changed significantly in 30 years, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a workplace which has exactly the same number of personnel in it now than it did 30 years ago, just for starters. But the effort that we are pursuing is to ensure, as I have always been committed to doing, that our bureaucrats, our diplomats in this case, are well supported by our organisation, are backed in to do the job that they do, and I know they work extremely hard. I think it is a highly contested environment. There are a lot of new posts opened by other countries as well, and we are endeavouring to make sure that Australia has the presence that it needs, and that the Pacific merits, frankly, in opening up those posts. But we will always work within our means as a government, and that is a tenet of faith for a coalition government, and I'm absolutely confident that a Treasurer-turned-Prime Minister is going to ensure that I keep to that.
Thank you, Michael Ahrens. You mentioned Minister this question of protection against cyber attack and the role of the signals agency in private sector, but I have a feeling that we are still well behind the eight ball in terms of handling that issue, and it seems to be an absolutely huge challenge for us to find the people who are able to handle all this challenge for us. That is, within government, with proper security clearances, are bright enough and well-trained enough to do that. So can you indicate that it is given the utmost priority from your perspective?
Michael, great to see you, and that is a very good question. I think any realistic entity, and I went through the entities that are exposed in cyber terms, if they are being realistic, would say that we are still on the path to the level of protection that we need. And it's a little like the line that is often used in relation to unfortunately terrorist attacks. Those who are protecting us from those attacks have to be lucky all the time. The terrorists only really need to be lucky, for want of a much better word, once. Those who seek to exploit cyber opportunities in a malevolent way really only need to be lucky to get in once. So the cost of that eternal vigilance, the cost of that eternal vigilance is considerable. So after the independent intelligence review, which obviously considered ASD within it, and also as part of the first principles review of the Department of Defence, ASD has moved into a much different position in the structure of the intelligence community. So a standalone statutory agency run now by Mike Burgess, who will be familiar to many of you, with an absolute focus on its task of protecting Australians in that regard, working closely with their military counterparts in the ADF and across the Defence Department. Workforce, though, which you've also alluded to, is not just a challenge in that area. By and large, if you're a, I'm told, if you're a good signals intelligence analyst, then you have the sort of brain that works particularly well in the STEM space. And we know that facing us very soon is an enormous personnel challenge in the STEM space, in defence and in national security. So not only have we, for example, indicated a significant increase in staff for ASD, but we've also stood up a Department of Home Affairs, which is entirely focused on national security, and its agencies and the bringing together of its corpus need to be staffed adequately as well. I myself have lost good staff to the development of the Home Affairs Agency, so I know this. I know this well. It's complicated even further, Michael, if I remind us all that we are engaged in this competition not nationally but internationally. So the best and the brightest and the people with those skills, as much as I want them and Australia wants them, so do the US and so do the UK and so do many of our other counterparts and partners around the world. So we are in a strong recruiting phase, encouraging people to work in this area, encouraging people to engage in the development of STEM skills. And on a less national security focused but equally important note, I would say that the work that the government decided to do when we were elected from 2013 in defence industry is also a very strong pull for people with those skills. So if you're going to build offshore Pacific patrol boats, offshore patrol vessels, Hunter-class frigates and future submarine multiples, 54 vessels in total, the number of naval architects, engineers, skilled STEM personnel you need to do that is enormous. So big job, but we're on it.
Thanks for your time, Minister Kathleen Calderwood from ABC News. Could you give us an update on Hakeem Al-Arabi, who was detained in Thailand earlier this week? He's a Melbourne refugee. And what is the government doing to help him? He's at threat of being deported back to Bahrain.
Thanks very much, Kathleen. I understand Mr. Al-Harabi's issue has been raised with the Thai government. I understand he's, of course, not an Australian citizen, as you'd be aware, and he is also travelling on UN papers. So we have raised that matter. Our post in Thailand is aware of it and following up on that.
I saw Alexandra Dayant, also from the Institute.
Hi, Minister. Another in-house question. So I work on Pacific issues here at the Institute, and I wanted to talk about the infrastructure financing facility that Scott Morrison announced. So my understanding is that it's going to give more loans to the Pacific. And while I understand that it's actually very important for a foreign program to give loans, when you look at the Pacific, most of the nations are under a financial debt distress, according to the IMF. So don't you think that actually giving more loans to this, to these nations would actually worsen the situations of the Pacific?
Ensuring that the engagement is a sustainable one will be a condition precedent on any provision of loans from Australia. So we would not be adding to a debt burden in any country. That is not the plan and would not be sensible. There is also, as you would have noted in the announcement, a grants component as well. And these are in development. We need to be responsive to the needs of the Pacific. We need to be responsive to their priorities. And that is the approach that we will be taking. But there is no intention whatsoever of adding to debt burdens which already exist, but ensuring that any request for financing is analysed in that context.
Minister, I might ask you one more question on China, if I may. A lot of us have noted the hardening of attitudes towards China in Washington. What did you think of Vice President Mike Pence's recent forward-leaning speech on China? And can you tell me, do Canberra and Washington think about China in the same way these days?
Well, I think the Vice President's speech is a matter for him. Somebody recently asked me to adjudicate on his tone, and even as a former debating adjudicator, I couldn't be tempted to do that. We have obviously been working very hard ourselves in the region to ensure that China and Australia, and I was in Beijing just recently, as you would be aware, that China and Australia have a strong and robust relationship, one that is built on mutual respect, and one in which, where there are issues of difference, and I can't identify a perfect relationship in the world that doesn't have issues of difficulty, but one where we are able to manage those issues respectfully and appropriately together. And I think that we have had very successful engagements in China recently. Minister Birmingham and I tag-teamed. He attended the export import expo in Shanghai as I was heading into Beijing. So I'm pleased with where the work we have been doing has landed us. I am pleased to have a productive and constructive relationship with my counterpart, State Councillor Foreign Minister Wang Yi. And the Prime Minister has also had a very good meeting with Premier Li Keqiang at the East Asia Summit and a discussion with President Xi at APEC. So we have been at all points of the government working very hard with our major trading partner, our largest trading partner, to ensure that our relationship is in a good space and is robust and respectful and based on that mutual respect. And that has been a very productive process. From the United States' point of view, they clearly have significant concerns about the behaviour of China in the international trading context. And I respect those concerns, but we have said repeatedly, and I'm sure the Prime Minister will repeat this in Argentina, that we very much encourage them to come to a discussion where they can work this out, rather than calling out at each other across the ocean, and that it would be to everybody's advantage. It would certainly be to the advantage of the world trading system to identify where it needs reform and is in need of reform. That has been clear and been discussed for some time, and for it to be fit for purpose for a 21st century piece of architecture, as I said. These things are not immutable. And so that is obviously a work in progress. From the US perspective, they will work in their own interests on these matters, but we have taken a pragmatic and balanced approach between our strongest ally, our largest trading partner, but we do hope that we can encourage a constructive engagement between them. We know that the presidents had a conversation recently, private as opposed to social media, and we would welcome that continued engagement.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've run out of time. The Minister has been very generous today in giving us, as I said, a substantive speech, then taking our questions on all parts of the world, from Port Moresby to Beijing to Washington and elsewhere. We're very grateful to her for making her time. Delighted to welcome her back in her new role as Minister for Foreign Affairs. So please join me in thanking Maurice Payne.